good without you.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome David Ciminello, author of the new novel, The Queen of Steeplechase Park, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. David's a Lambda Literary Fellow and recipient of a Table 4 Writers Foundation grant. His short fiction has appeared in the Lambda Award-winning anthology, Portland Queer, Tales of the Rose City, and in Stephen O'Donnell's The Untold Gaze. His poetry has been published in Poetry Northwest. David's original screenplay, Bruno, was made into a movie directed by Shirley MacLaine and starring Kathy Bates, Gary Sinise, and Jennifer Tilly. David's also an actor, with credits including Another World, Days of Our Lives, Kojak, Matlock, Murder, She Wrote, and Seinfeld. In the words of Lydia Yuknovich, David Ciminello has reanimated Depression-era Coney Island with such vivid and dazzling detail that I wanted to laugh, cry, eat a hot dog, and go for a swim all at once. A phenomenal story of a burlesque queen searching for her lost baby in the glitz, ooze, and hum of sideshows from Brighton to Gravesend. I couldn't put it down. Please join us for our conversation with David, which is already in progress. Well, David, thanks for dropping by KBOO on this beautiful early summer day.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you described The Queen of Steeplechase Park as fact-based fiction, so I thought we'd get to a few of those facts first, some of them from your own life. So let's go back to you, David, at 8 years old, growing up in Wayne, New Jersey. It's after school. You're watching TV with your mom, the 4:30 movie, which I guess was on every weekday. They're playing the 1962 musical Gypsy, starring Natalie Wood as Gypsy Rose Lee. You ask your mom a question any kid probably would watching the movie: what's a stripper? And that turns out to be the spark for this book.
Yeah. I was enthralled by that movie for a number of reasons. One, of course, being Natalie Wood, who was spectacular. My mother looked a lot like Natalie Wood when she was younger, actually. So she was a favorite of my mom's as well. And yeah, we were watching Gypsy. And it was after the Gotta Have a Gimmick number where the strippers teach Natalie Wood, a.k.a. Gypsy Rose Lee, what stripping is all about. And I turned to my mother after the number was over, and she was giggling. And I said, "Why? What's so funny?" And my mother said, "Well, my aunt used to do that." And I said, "What aunt?" She said, "My Aunt Emily, your great Aunt Emily."
Who you knew?
Who I knew was a stripper in Coney Island. And, you know, that I my eight-year-old brain tried to absorb that. I tried to put my aunt in Gypsy in one of those costumes, and it was a perfect fit. I completely understood. I got it, and it never left my head, and I carried that image and that idea with me for the rest of my life.
That must have given you a very different impression of your great aunt Emily. What did you know? What did you know about her before seeing Gypsy and hearing your mom's story?
It enhanced the impression I had. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so she was, there's a character in the book, the main character, Belladonna, right. Marie Donato, and she's based on
my great aunt. Yeah. And my great aunt was a bombastic, bodacious, loud, hilarious character that by the time I came along was living in California. So she would blow into town literally like a hurricane, like a colorful hurricane, and have the entire family in stitches the entire time she was there. And I would watch her, you know, from a corner or from a chair or from behind a door, fascinated. I was quite an introverted kid. She was quite an extrovert, of course, and was really actually a bit spooked by me. She thought,
because you're so quiet.
Yeah, she didn't get it. What the heck is that kid's problem? But I was fascinated, and I just would observe her and watch her and just soak in as much as I could.
Now, you mentioned Coney Island, where your Aunt Emily was a stripper, and Bella in the book also is a stripper, their burlesque dancer. That's the location of Steeplechase Park, where the title comes from. It was the first of Coney Island's three big amusement parks. It was built in 1897. That was followed by Luna Park in 1903, Dreamland in 1904. Did you go as a kid?
I never did.
Ah!
No, never. I actually didn't go to Coney Island until I was well into writing this book. And I thought I better get my tail out there and see what this is all about, even if it's just mere remnants of what used to be there. So the Coney Island that I created in the book was really mostly culled from research, I'd have to say, enhanced by the trip I took out there after I was knee-deep writing the book.
Yeah. And did you live out there with your husband, Brian? I thought I saw somewhere where it was for 10 years you guys lived on Coney Island, and was that to do research?
Yeah, no, we didn't live in Coney Island. So I'm originally from New Jersey, northern Jersey, about 20 miles northwest of Manhattan. That's where I grew up.
And that's Wayne?
Wayne, New Jersey, a little suburb, which is not so little anymore. I went to school in D.C., Catholic University in Washington, D.C., to study acting. I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in theater, went back up to New York with an agent in my back pocket and a screen test for a soap opera. Didn't get the soap opera, but ended up going out for a lot of other things. Eventually found my way to Los Angeles, as most actors do, and did a lot of television and film work out there.
You did appear in at least two soap operas, though, didn't you?
Yes.
Was it One Life to Live, one of them?
No, I screen tested for One Life to Live.
Oh, was that with Marisa Tomei?
That was As the World Turns.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that was my mom's favorite.
That was my grandpa's favorite. And I'll tell you something, my fingers were crossed and I was praying I would get on that because it was my grandpa's favorite show. I screen tested for about nine screen tests all total for soap operas. There were about 13 of them on the air in the mid 80s. So there was a lot of work for actors on those shows. I was a senior in college. I was wrapping up my senior year when Mary Lynn Henry, who was head of casting for ABC Daytime, who was an alum, came down to the school and held an open call. She was sweeping the country looking for two young men, one for One Life to Live and one for a show called Ryan's Hope. And she and Suzanne Ringrose, who was the casting director for Ryan's Hope, pulled me out of school and gave me a screen test.
Was that an interest of yours to be an actor?
Absolutely. No, that's what I was getting my degree in, was a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in acting. So to be pulled into Manhattan as my senior year was ending to screen test for one of my favorite shows was a particular thrill. Yeah. And then I went on to do tests for As the World Turns, One Life to Live. I ended up eventually on a show called Another World in New York City around the time that Anne Heche began her soap opera career. And it was a thrill to sort of stand in the wings and watch her do her work. She was only 18 years old, and I was, as an actor, if not otherwise, completely smitten. I was just in awe of her work. And then I ended up in L.A., and I became sort of an NBC kid in that regard. I did a recurring role, a non-contract regular role on a show called Generations, which was on for a while, and then ended up on a show called Days of Our Lives.
Oh, and I also have down here, I looked up IMDb, your record there, Kojak.
Yeah.
Matlock, yeah. Murder, She Wrote, and even an episode of Seinfeld, which I know very well, called The Barber.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So I was doing a lot of episodic television, a lot of guest star roles, and it was a lot of fun. Yeah, and I think the crowning achievement, the pinnacle, was the Seinfeld episode.
Oh, and there's a great story connected with that, where you auditioned, got a call, I think that night, from Larry David.
That's right, that's right. So I went in for the nephew barber. At that point in time, it was they were looking for two uncles and a nephew. There was a plot with Jerry Seinfeld and a bad haircut, and then there was another subplot with Elaine, something to do with a barber chair. Uh-huh. And that was involving the nephew of one of the uncles who ran this barber shop. And it came down to me and one other actor for the part. I went in, I read for Jerry, I read for Larry David, and I got the part. I went in for the table read. I got home that night. You know, and I was thinking to myself, after the table read, you know, these shows are about 20 minutes, you know, with about 10 minutes of commercials. That's the half hour. And this script is 40 pages. That's 40 minutes. It's generally a minute a page in terms of screenplays. And I thought they're going to have to cut something. And if they cut that Elaine plot, that would make it all work. And sure enough, I got that phone call that night. I was in the middle of prepping my spaghetti dinner for the evening, and the phone rang, and it was Larry David. And he said, "Hey, David, it's Larry David. The episode's running long. Apologies, but we're going to have to cut the nephew. I'm so sorry. Hopefully we'll get you back on the show another time. You were terrific." "Oh, thank you, Larry." Okay. Hung up, went to the market to get my spaghetti. I came back. The phone rang. "Hey, it's Larry David. We're in a story meeting. Hang on. Stay by the phone." Okay. Hung up. 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, the phone rang. "It's Larry. You're in. See you tomorrow."
That must have been great news.
It was wonderful news. And they well, for me and not for one of the actors playing one of the uncles, they cut him, gave me his part, kept the Jerry haircut plot, and got rid of the Elaine subplot, but shooed me into the other plot. And it was a lot of fun. It was like putting on a play. Sitcoms are like putting on plays. It's a week-long rehearsal period. It's done ultimately, eventually, in front of a live studio audience twice, and it's done in order, so it's done like a play. And I had a blast. It was
the big difference is, unlike a play, once you do a TV episode like a Seinfeld, you're on television in perpetuity.
In perpetuity.
I mean, that Barber episode must have run thousands and thousands of times, probably hundreds of times almost every day all over the world.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that, in particular of all of the work I've done in LA, because it's a classic. And so to be a part of is a bit of a thrill. And just to get back to your initial question of living in New York, et cetera, I went from LA up to Portland to become a writer, a serious writer, hopefully a serious writer. And then I met my husband, Brian, and was thinking about going to grad school to get an MFA in writing. Applied to schools back east because I thought, well, I want to live in New York at least one more time before I die, before I leave the planet. And I got into grad school there and ended up living in Sunnyside, Queens for 10 years. And really, really enjoyed it.
I grew up in Queens. I was born there.
Oh, where were you born?
Flushing area.
Okay.
Not far from Shea Stadium or whatever it is now.
Right. So you know it well then.
I left when I was about 12. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've been back, but not really to Queens. Mostly hang out in Manhattan when we go back.
Yeah.
But yeah, I loved it back there. I mean, it's a whole different culture.
Sure. Sunnyside is this little pocket of a community built in the 1920s. It's connected. It's a community, sort of a 1 or 2 square mile community of connected brick townhouses with common gardens behind them.
That was very much like where I grew up. It was a kind of a private community called Fresh Meadows,
okay,
which I think was owned by New York Life Insurance.
All right.
But it was brick. We lived in a brick duplex. There were 3-story buildings. There were a few 10-story buildings.
Right.
There was a lot of common areas.
Yeah.
We played stickball against the wall.
Right. Right. So these little common gardens, it was like something out of London. It was wonderful. And I remember one night I was walking down the street. I had taken a walk. It was early evening, but it was dark. And I was walking down my street back to my house, and someone had a television on in their living room, and it was the Seinfeld episode. And I was so tempted to knock on that door and ask if they needed a haircut, but I didn't.
That would have been fantastic.
Yeah,
I think they would have enjoyed it if they didn't shoot you first.
Right.
Yeah. Or throw something at you. They're New Yorkers, after all. Before we head to Portland here, I had one more a question about your time in Los Angeles, because you were writing then, too. You were a screenwriter, and you actually had a movie produced. 2000 release called Bruno.
Yeah.
It wasn't small time either. It was directed by Shirley MacLaine. She starred in it with Gary Sinise and Kathy Bates. And what was that like working with people like Shirley MacLaine and those great actors, and this time as a screenwriter, not as a member of the cast?
Yeah, that was a thrilling experience in many respects, and it was quite unique because generally writers are not allowed on the set. They're not a part of the process. Once the script is sold, it's out of your hands generally as a screenwriter. But Shirley had me on the set every day, and I was there for the entire shoot. And I got to observe and work with her and work with people like Kathy Bates and Gary Sinise and Jennifer Tilly. So even though the script or the film didn't turn out the way I would have liked it to have turned out, it wasn't the movie that I would have directed necessarily. It was really thrilling to work with people of that caliber, I have to say.
I was going to ask you also, which you probably get a lot, the difference between screenwriting and writing fiction. One of them is, I think, what you just mentioned, the lack of control as a screenwriter. Once you finish the script and it's being filmed, usually the writer has no further say. But that's as exactly a fiction writer, you're in the process all the way.
Yeah.
It's your edits to make or to reject.
That's right. As a novelist, as a fiction writer, as a prose writer, I am in complete charge of my universe. I cast it. I direct it. I do the costumes. I do the sets. I do it all.
Unlimited budget.
And an unlimited budget. What could be better?
Now, living in Portland, so when you moved up here, David, I think your first writing group was Tom Spanbauer's Dangerous Writers.
He was one of the first. So the very first writing workshop I took in Portland was at a place called the Attic Institute, run by a gentleman by the name of David Beispiel.
Oh, okay. And that's where you did your flash fiction workshop?
That was exactly right.
And that also led to the book, along with Gypsy.
Yes.
When you were 8 years old, this is another important milestone.
Right. Yeah, I had gone to Florida where my great aunt was living around that time in the early 2000s and interviewed her because I was fascinated and I wanted to know more about her story with the idea that I was going to maybe write about her. It was after the movie, after I had left Los Angeles and come up to Portland to sort of find out where my creativity might take me. And my aunt told me a few stories about her Coney Island adventures, and one of them was the interview for the dance job, which in the book is the chapter entitled The Jewish Cigar. It is basically her, all the dialogue in that chapter is hers.
That's amazing. Yeah, that came from the recording.
That came directly from the recording. So I had that in my back pocket when I took this flash fiction workshop with David Beispiel, who up until that point really only taught poetry workshops, being an incredible poet and now a prose writer, now a novelist, but at that time hadn't taught any fiction workshops, and it was wonderful. It was terrific. He was terrific, and he threw out a prompt, and I had that interview in my back pocket, and I just wrote the story of her interview for the dance job in that workshop, and that's really, I think, where the novel was born.
The events were similar to what your aunt went through. There's, I think the agent's name, is it?
In the book, Lester Feinberg.
Feinberg, yes.
Yeah, no, that's
so the Jewish agent in Midtown Manhattan. Right. And he, and then it's a moment where Bella kind of asserts herself. The agent was trying to take advantage of the situation, but didn't get very far.
I don't know in reality how far he got. I'll bet he got a little farther than in the book, but
that wasn't part of the interview in the recording with your
No.
You got the censor, the expurgated version.
I did. But in all its glory, in all its bodacious glory, what she was willing to reveal, I got, and what she
filled
didn't
in
reveal,
the rest.
Exactly. No pun intended. I filled in the rest.
Now I love. I heard that you actually had a chance to read your Aunt Emily the flash fiction, the story, the chapter in the book, The Jewish Cigar, over the phone before she passed. Yeah. What did she think of the chapter, and did she know you were writing a book based on her life, and you were using those recordings?
she did. She knew why I was down there to interview her, and she was excited. She was a fan of the movie, was starstruck, and thought she was going to be the next big discovery of mine. So she was really, really excited. And when I got back to Portland, I wrote that chapter. I called her and I read it to her over the phone. And she paused. There was a moment of silence. And then she said, "Boy, you must really love me."
There's no higher praise.
No higher praise.
There's no reviewer who could top that.
No. And that gave me the impetus and the inspiration to just keep going and to go whole hog. Unfortunately, she passed away not long after that. So she didn't get to see much more of what she inspired. But she was really excited. She would say things to various relatives like, I'm in the book. I'm going to be in the book. But little did she know, she is the book. She is the book.
And we'll get to this a little later, but the books, possibly plural here.
Hopefully. Yeah, we'll see. I have a whole bunch of material.
Now, how many recordings did you make with Emily where she was talking to you about her life? Was it just that once?
It was just that one
agent,
afternoon.
The burlesque dance of agent.
Yeah, it was just that one afternoon of interviews and questioning and so forth. Yeah.
As you were writing the book, you were in a sense channeling her in the guise of Belle in the book. Did she start, she must have, start coming alive for you on the page? And did you learn anything about her that you didn't already know?
About my great aunt or about Bella?
Oh, well, one and the same.
Fair enough. That's a great question. Let me think.
Well, you already filled in some blanks in the office.
That's right.
In a way she might or might not have reacted, but based on who she was appearing as to you.
Right.
In that Jewish cigar chapter.
Exactly. And what I knew of her and what I knew from stories that were passed down through family folklore, through tales, you know, various stories about her life. All of these hard, cold, hilarious, sometimes hilarious facts. The fact that she got pregnant when she was 15, the fact that she was really incredibly wild and very sexual at a very young age, the fact that she had the baby was taken away from her without consent, and then her parents, her father, had her sterilized. So those were the facts that I knew. Those were not facts that I discussed with my great aunt in any great detail. I wasn't sure how to approach that with her, how much I could ask her. She had just reunited with her son at that point, who was in his 60s. She was in her
80s. I was going to talk about that because she's looking for her son in the book. Bella's looking for her son in the book.
She is.
And I don't think it's giving too much away, but in either part two or part three, chances are they'll get reunited.
Chances are. Right. Stay tuned.
There's a little foreshadowing in this present novel.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Now, you had Emily's voice on tape, and as you mentioned, used much of the dialogue verbatim in that first piece, The Jewish Cigar, how she was hired as a dancer for the Coney Island Burlesque Show. But the book's written in the third person, close, since you get inside the heads of each character. I was wondering, and it's a great narration. it's zesty, brash, loud, funny, fast-paced. Did you consider writing in the first person at all with Bella as narrator rather than coming through through this third-person narration?
Never.
Ah, never. Interesting.
Because
you had her voice, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've never been a first-person writer. I've never been a fan of first-person, generally first-person writing. And that was a tricky deal going into Tom Spanbauer's workshop. I mean, speaking of Tom Spanbauer, I studied with him after that initial workshop with David Beispiel at the Attic, and I loved studying with Tom. But I was one of the very few. He was a big proponent of first-person point of view.
Well, it's the dangerous writers group. And exactly. By dangerous, he doesn't mean you guys going out on the street and beating people up. It's revealing things about yourself in your writing that you might be circumspect.
Exactly.
About revealing.
Exactly. And I was not a first person. I like third person. I like the omniscience. I like the permission that gives me to float around. You know, my camera can go anywhere, you know, as a third person writer. So I was one of the few third person writers in The Dangerous Basement. And I was blessed to be there. I love Tom. He's a literary angel. And I learned a lot from him, how to go on the body, how to go in the body, how to go on the scene, how to go vertical, how to, you know, get into the character's head and body and soul. And
is
mind.
That what going vertical means, to get further into the character's
deeper
head?
Deeper and deeper. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Into the character's soul and motivations. Yeah.
Now, how did you arrive at the narrator's voice, that third-person narration? There's elements in there of like a circus ringmaster, a Coney Island carnival barker, 30 screwball comedies. I heard like actresses like Katharine Hepburn in there, or there's...
Rosalind Russell.
Rosalind Russell. I kind of heard all that in the narration. It was just amazing. It kind of brings you back there, but just carries you along like a wave on the beach at Coney Island.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. The musicality of the writing is something that came to me through, I would say mostly through the subject matter and through my great aunt and who she was. You know, the sachet of her hips, the way she walked, the machine gun fire of her delivery when she talked. That's who she was. And I also, as a writer, write to music. all the time.
Oh, and, so you're listening to music as you're writing?
Constantly.
Was it the music of that era? You mentioned, Paul Whiteman, I think, mm-hmm. in there. There's a Louis Armstrong song that you mentioned. And then her theme song seems to be All of Me.
All of Me. Why not take All of Me? Which was my aunt's favorite song. She told me that. And she sang it to me over the phone. And it was, when she sang it to me, when she told me that, I thought, of course, it has to be All of Me. What other song could it be? I listened to songs from the 1930s and 40s and 20s. I listened to movie soundtracks. I listened to contemporary pop songs. If they speak to me and they're relevant to the material and I find them inspiring, I listen to music all the time.
And that must have some influence on your writing, even though the narration, though you're listening to different kinds of music, it's stable throughout. It's one voice.
Right. And I taught poetry for 8 years in the Bronx. I don't consider myself a poet, but I gravitate toward poetic writing. And I taught kids third, fourth, and fifth grade poetry and taught them to slam and had them slam competitively in New York. I did that for 4 years, taught poetry.
You won a competition there, didn't you?
Several. Oh. Yeah, and I didn't. My kids did.
Oh, the kids did.
They were amazing.
The coach gets some credit.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, and the teachers. I worked with some incredible teachers. A big shout out to Ms. Diaz and Mr. Brock and Ms. Kidd. So poetry, all of those literary devices that poets use to create a sort of a rhythm and a musicality in writing is something that I find I love to do. You know, things like alliteration and repetition and all of those wonderful poetic devices.
And you're helped along at keeping up that pace by these short chapters. Almost every chapter is short, maybe one or two pages sometimes,
right,
interspersed with about 16 food recipes and some other recipes that are, or some other parts of the narration that are in recipe format.
Yeah.
So it just really moves the reader along. I just love that. I think some readers have described it as breezy. It's just delightful and really, you're just carried along by the voice and also by the short chapters. You want to keep going.
Yeah, and that wasn't really, honestly, that wasn't a conscious thing. I didn't make a conscious...
That's what I was going to ask, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't make a conscious decision. Well, I know how I'm going to get this to be breezy and
short chapters.
And hustle along, it's going to be short chapters. That's just something I gravitated to as a reader and as a writer myself, you know, as a writer who reads or a reader who writes, I should say, is anything that's really unconventional. I like books that, you know, the reader has to kind of work to put it together. Rubik's cubes, little puzzles. I like things that are non-linear, things that are unconventional in terms of style and presentation. So that's just something I do because it's something I enjoy reading, I think, mostly. You know, and so I came to the idea of doing short chapters, title chapters, based on my love for books that I've read that are like that, like Mr. Bridge and Mrs. Bridge, those
Evan
two
S.
books,
Connell.
Or which are short titled chapters, which are terrific. Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe.
Fanny Flagg, who blurbed your book, by the way.
who blurbed my book. That was pretty amazing. I'm a huge fan of hers. So these are the books that I've enjoyed. And my initial idea with this book actually was to tell it non-linearly.
I was going to ask about that. In fact, the very first piece you wrote, The Jewish Cigar, doesn't appear in the book until about halfway.
Yeah.
So at some point you decided to do it chronologically, starting with Bella as just a young child, a very boisterous one, but...
Yeah, that came from a professor, Lucy Rosenthal at Sarah Lawrence, where I got my MFA. You know, I arrived at Sarah Lawrence with a laundry basket, a sort of a big suitcase full of material, and just sort of plopped it onto her desk and said, well, I want to make a book out of this, and I want to make a nonlinear book out of this. The idea was to sort of create a patchwork quilt of a novel that sort of...
Made up of these chapters, but not necessarily in chronological order.
Right. But I had this cockamamie idea that even nonlinearly, I would be able to somehow non-linearly create a linear arc, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? By going, jumping back and forth in time, maybe I could tell a story that has an arc of its own, or that has an arc that way. She just said, no, 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 no. Just write it linearly. You can always mix it up later. So I started writing it linearly just to sort of get it all out and get it all on the page. And I liked it. I thought it worked. And I thought I could jump around with flashbacks and things of that nature when I needed to. And that that would maybe work. And I think it did.
I think it works very well. And I think it will stand you in good stead as you go through to the next two volumes.
Yeah, thank you.
In the book. Now, you've said, I've heard you say, David, that all your writing starts with character. Mm. And in Bella, you had a great one for the Queen of Steeplechase Park. But there are also several very memorable characters in the book. I went to your Powell's book launch, and you were asked a question about your favorites, besides Bella, of course. And you mentioned Bella's brother, little Luigi, and her younger brother. Mm-hmm. She comes from a big family. And her brother-in-law, Joe. Why those two?
Well,
kindness, loyalty, they are both very good to her.
Yeah, they are. And you know, all of these characters, a fair amount of these characters, particularly the family characters, are based on family members of my own. So the character of Joe is based on my grandfather, my Aunt Emily's, Bella's brother-in-law. Conchetta is based on my grandmother, Mary. Lulu is based on my Aunt Alice, my Aunt Emily's sister.
Luigi?
Luigi's based on Louis, my great-uncle Louis,
ah.
My great-Aunt Emily's younger brother. All of these archetypes came to me through real people. I created these sort of archetypes. These mythic characters were born out of these relatives that I grew up watching and observing and living amongst. So they're very, in a lot of ways, they're, even though they ended up blooming into self-actualized characters of their own right, separate from the people I grew up with, they're very dear to me. They're very dear to me.
And you, of course, you did take fictional liberties. I think you've mentioned that Bella's father, who's somewhat cruel and abusive in the book, is nothing like your dad or your grandfather.
Oh, my great-grandfather, uh-huh. No, nothing at all like
him. That Aunt Emily's dad, yeah.
Right, right. So my great-grandpa Agar and my great-grandmother were lovely people, not at all like the characters in the book.
But you need some conflict there, so Manny provided.
Exactly. For the sake of drama, I created these characters as they stand in the book, yeah.
Can I tell you my favorite character?
Please.
Besides Bella, of course. Torelli Lombardi. Mm. He actually, Bella meets him, I think he's about a year younger than she is, mm-hmm. but kind of, he has a very strange home life. He lives in luxury, but he gives her the ad for the Coney Island Dancer where she meets the agent in the Jewish cigar section. And not only that, but gives her a makeover. He's, what does she call him, a Nancy boy in the book? And later on, he's called an invert because at that time they considered being gay or queer was abnormal, something wrong with him. And I just loved his character. As he's over the top, but kind, but direct, funny. And I did hear from you that he was planned as a minor character just to appear in the beginning of the book. But he shows up later and he takes on a much bigger role. You must have kind of fallen for him too on the page when you were writing him, to kind of give him extra life in the book.
I loved him from the get go.
Ah.
He was a character born completely out of my heart, not based in any sort of reality.
No counterpart in your own life.
No. Except of course, like with most writers, I guess, you know, we're every character that's in our work. You know, every character is some part of who we are, right? That's what I believe anyway. And so Torelli Lombardi is that little queer boy trapped in my heart, the one that I grew up being and mostly wanted to be.
You've called him unabashedly queer.
Right.
So very proud of it. He's very,
very
upfront about it.
Unapologetic. The way I would be if I could go back in time and sashay my way through elementary school or even junior high school and high school the way Torelli does. You know, I really admire him. So he's this sort of this little Truman Capote kind of independent spirit that is a piece of who Bella is in a lot of respects. You know, she's a misfit and an outcast. He's a misfit and an outcast. She's bold and unapologetic. He's bold and unapologetic.
Right.
So when the two come together, there is a spark of recognition that neither can resist.
In addition to Truman Capote, you've described him also as a bit of a Henry Higgins, like in My Fair Lady.
That's exactly
where
right.
he kind of makes over Bella, but also Bella's beau in the book, Francis.
Right. Right. Well, he's in love with Francis Anthony Mozzarelli.
Oh,
who,
yeah. That causes a little
rift between the two of them.
But he basically makes them who they are.
Right.
He takes Francis, in fact, to the gym and has him work on his body and all that. And he's just a knockout for everybody in the neighborhood, even the priest at St. Anthony's.
That's right.
And then
That's
Bella,
right.
he turns into, well, she was the raw material, but he polished her up quite a bit.
Yeah, Torelli knew a gorgeous pile of clay when he saw it, and he had the wherewithal and the talent to take that pile of clay and mold it into something spectacular, and he knew that. And so when he encounters Francis and then later Bella, he decides to roll up his sleeves and make them into something spectacular. It's a little bit of Henry Higgins, Pygmalion, but it's also a little bit of Frankenstein, I think.
yes, he
creates a couple of monsters.
Now, he has Hollywood dreams, as you did, becoming an actor, but not for the usual reasons of just getting a job in movies, and he wanted to be a makeup artist. But he knows, unlike where he lives in New York and New Jersey, he knows Hollywood is much more accepting of people like him. And he tells Bella about actors like Clark Gable, Greta Garbo, Joan Crawford, who are not what they seem on screen or in the movie magazines, the screen.
That's right. Yeah. Don't believe everything you read, Torelli says.
Yeah. So he just figures there's a place for people like him out in Hollywood.
Hollywood is teeming with inverts, he says. Yeah. Greta Garbo and Joan Crawford, for starters. No, Greta Garbo and Joan Crawford. Bella says, come on, you know, Joan Crawford's in love with Clark Gable. Oh, no, she's in love with Greta Garbo. Trust me.
Well, Hollywood was doing that long after that, too, I think.
That's absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
Now, at one point in the story, you mentioned he calls himself an invert, but other people call him that. And his mother sends him away for conversion therapy at the time. And you detail the horrors of the place he gets sent to in the practice, which includes electroshock treatments. It's just brutal. So they were called inverts. They were considered defective in some ways. And you did the research. These places really existed. In fact, there's still some conversion therapy going on in some states. Hopefully not quite as, cruel as this, but I don't know. It seems the very concept is cruel.
Right. The very concept is cruel. And it was really important for me to speak to that and to speak against that. You're right. You had mentioned earlier that Torelli was only in the beginning of the book initially. And when I had was shopping the book around to agents, when I was querying around, I got what's called in the business an R&R, a revise and resubmit request from Writer's House in New York City. And the assistant that read the manuscript had emailed me with a wonderful email, a very long, detailed email about all of the things she liked and then about the three things she thought should be addressed if they were to consider moving forward in taking the manuscript on. One of the things was to create and tell the backstory of Bella's parents. So that initially wasn't in the book.
Oh, okay. So how they met and in Sicily and... Well, again, I shouldn't give too much away, but there's a twist there.
There is a twist.
Considering Bella's mom. And then they came to America and he got his job at the Scale Factory.
Right. So all made up and all came later off of this wonderful assistant's suggestion.
And number two?
Number two was she suggested beefing up some of the supporting characters.
Like Torelli.
In particular, Torelli.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, that's...
He's got that charm. He's got that aura. Huh?
He deserves... Right. He deserves an extended period of time in the spotlight. I can do that. So...
And you created him from scratch. So,
completely.
So no counterpart. Wow. It's just brilliance.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. He's a particular favorite of mine, too, I have to say. So I thought I'll give him a complete arc. I'll take him all the way to the end of the book if need be. Early on in the book, he does mention that his mother keeps threatening to send him away and have the sissy hosed out of him. And I thought, well, let's see what happens there. Let's see. Let's have him do that, her do that, and see what transpires. And so I was able to dramatize this horrible concept of conversion therapy, which is still practiced in some places today.
And you probably didn't make up too much in that section. I mean, electroshock therapy. Was it used then? This was late 30s, I guess.
Yeah, I think just about starting then. So I may have inched my way, you know, forward or back a little bit, but I did a lot of research. So most of that is really spot on. And I also, my critique partner, Patsy Kohlberg, who is a wonderful writer, has got a couple of novels of her own out there and is shopping one around now. I work one-on-one with her. We meet generally once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks via Zoom and critique each other's work. And she's a retired doctor, so she was a huge help with that and another medical procedure in the book, helping me get that correct. Hopefully.
It's just really difficult to read, but Torelli triumphs.
Of course he does.
And I won't tell how. Yeah. But now, food plays a big part in the book. It's part of Bella's magic, besides her just incredible personality. I think he includes 16 food recipes, mostly Italian dishes, from meatballs and tomato gravy. And I know there's a debate whether to call it tomato sauce or gravy.
Right.
In New Jersey, I guess it's called gravy.
Growing up, for me, it was called gravy. That's what my Italian grandmother called it. So,
that's what it's called in the book.
That's what it's called in the book. Thank you, Grandma Ciminello.
You have chicken parmesan, lasagna, risotto, chicken cacciatore, frutti di mare, eggplant parmesan, which is my one and only specialty. We talked a little bit about that. And of course, you got to have dessert, so you have cannoli in there. Mm. So I was surprised to learn, David, that you didn't cook as a child.
No, I didn't. But I grew up among people, women primarily, who cooked. Who
were your mom.
Fantastic cooks. Yeah, my mom, who was Portuguese, as was my great aunt. Okay, so I'm half Portuguese and half Italian. Italian 100% on my father's side, Portuguese pretty much 100% on my mother's side. But my mother lived on Kruger Place, which is featured in the book, and went across the street to LaMonaco's Market and learned from Mary LaMonaco, who in the book is Big Betty LaMonaco.
Big Betty LaMonaco. So, right. So you didn't change too much there. Last name.
Yeah, didn't change too much there. But my mother learned to cook from her and learned how to make tomato gravy with her eye on my father, who of course was Italian. And my mother was an amazing cook. Growing up eating her chicken parmesan and her meatballs and her stuffed shells and all of her food, anything Italian or otherwise that my mother made was absolutely delicious, and got the number one seal of approval from her father-in-law, from my grandpa Ciminello. And my grandmother Ciminello was an amazing Italian cook, and my grandma Jack, my mother's mother, was an incredible Portuguese cook. I mean, her stuffed quahogs and her boiled Portuguese dinners, her squash and her ham and her boiled potatoes and her stuffed Cornish game hens, with half of them stuffed with stuffing and half of them stuffed with wild rice stuffing. My mouth is watering just thinking about
me
it.
Me too.
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up with incredible food, eating just and taking it all for granted. And it wasn't until I found myself in California pursuing my professional career as an actor and my life as an adult that I started cooking for myself. And my mother sent me her favorite Italian cookbook.
Did some of them end up in the book then?
Some of
your mom's recipes.
Oh, absolutely. And my grandmother's, my grandma Ciminello's baked chickens in there. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And did Mary LaMonaco identify the cooking spirit in your mom as Big Betty LaMonaco does in the book with Bella?
No.
She knows she's got something there. She's got this talent that that Bella didn't realize up until then. And it serves her very well throughout the story.
That's right. That's right.
Saves her in many cases.
Absolutely. Meatball saved my life once, and someday they're going to save yours too.
Right.
Big Betty says to Bella after she teaches her how to make tomato gravy, you know, come back and I'll teach you how to make the meatballs. No, the cooking spirit was something that I completely made up. You know, I'm a fan of magic realism in books and movies. And so it was important for me to integrate as much magical realism in the story as I could. And the cooking spirit just appeared one day, announced itself, introduced itself, and I took it from there.
That's a good segue into my next question, because the publisher here, Laura Stanfill, is also an author. And she wrote a book last year. I interviewed her for that. Singing Lessons for the Stylish Canary.
Canary, yeah.
And she also uses magical realism. So you have that connection. Yeah. But I know through the Dangerous Writers Group, you met Gigi Little, who designed this beautiful cover.
Yeah.
In fact, we had Phil from the station come in and use the studio just before me. And he just commented, I got to read that book, just based on the cover alone.
Right.
But she was also instrumental in getting the book published, though you already knew Laura. I guess you were in a writing group later on with her.
Yeah. So there was a group of people, small group of writers that branched out from Tom's Basement and formed their own little group, a little salon of writers called the Henry Group. And that's where I met Laura. And Laura was in the Henry Group. Yeah, so when it came time to shop the book around, I, of course, had Laura in the back of my mind and was sending queries out. And then when she opened Forest Avenue Press up for submissions, I sent it to her as well. And
Was Gigi the one who suggested or kind of nudged you in that direction?
No, actually, it was Patsy Kohlberg, my critique partner, who did it. She said to me one day as I was going through the query process, you know, Forest Avenue submissions are open. They just opened. I said, you're kidding. She said, no, I think you should submit Bella. And I said, I think I should. And I did. And I'm really...
And you gave a heads up to Laura that you had the manuscript coming
in. I did. Because I knew her. So I had to shoot her an email and say, oh, you know, by the way, Bella's in the inbox. I just thought I should let you know.
And she must have been acquainted with it, right, through the writing group when you were workshopping it?
She was. She was really... my understanding is that what she does with writers that she knows and work that she knows is she won't look at it. She'll sort of farm it out to a reader who doesn't know the writer and get their take on it, and then we'll proceed from there. So that's what she did with me. She gave it to a reader, and the feedback was, this is the book. and Laura then got very excited and read it and got in touch with me and said, I would really love to publish your book.
Were there much in the way of changes between the manuscript she accepted and after she started working with you as a publisher and an editor?
Great question. Not a whole lot. I had done a ton of work on the book before submitting it to Laura. And the last big chunk was off the R&R notes I got from the assistant at Writer's House.
Oh, I forgot to ask you, what was three?
Oh, three. Yeah, oh, the third three of the notes. Suggestion.
Yeah, right.
The ending. She felt that the ending of the book wasn't in keeping with the canon of the rest of the book. I don't want to address that in detail only because I don't want to give away any spoilers. But I will say this, and we talked about this earlier, that there might be a couple more books.
Part two and a part three.
Right.
We could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So what I ended up with after I was done at Sarah Lawrence was over 1,000 pages of material, a large book in three parts. And it became unmanageable. And huge, and something that's not really marketable these days.
Yeah, it's not 19th century Russia anymore.
Right, exactly. You know, War and Peace, Gone with the Wind is just not going to fly. So I thought, well, what if this book what if it's three books instead of one? And so part one became book one of the Belladonna trilogy, hopefully. And
so then, it's not the ending. It's just the ending of part one.
That's right. So the original ending of book one, of part one, was different than it is now, and it had to be adjusted to create a standalone book, if that makes sense.
Oh, I see. Rather than a cliffhanger or something like a serial in the 30s.
Exactly. It was a huge cliffhanger initially, and now it's just sort of a small, fun cliffhanger.
Now, part two, I've heard you say this on a podcast. It takes place in a rooming house in Brooklyn. Part three, Bella runs a truck stop cafe in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also based on Aunt Emily's life.
Yeah.
I read even, there was an excerpt from part two published, I don't know, about 7-8 years ago in a journal called Underwater New York. It was called Take Me Back to Dreamland.
Correct.
So I knew there were at least two characters in there that weren't in part one, unless their names were changed.
Well, yes, they were. Actually, so that was part of the change in the ending of book one.
Uh-huh.
I brought Torelli, of course, I extended Torelli Lombardi, gave him a complete arc, and I bring him all the way through to the end of the book. We won't say how he shows up or why or
what
happens.
And he had a different name originally?
No. So in book two, Bella ends up in a rooming house in Prospect Park, Brooklyn, based on my great aunt landing in a rooming house, sort of a very, who is the writer? Styron, Sophie's Choice type of situation in a rooming house, boarding house in Brooklyn. And I gave the house a landlord, an older gentleman, a very flamboyant gentleman who had a parrot and walked around wearing a kimono. So I thought, well, that's going to be Torelli. I'm just going to bring Torelli all the way through all three books, and the landlord of the house in Prospect Park is going to be Torelli Lombardi.
Oh, I'm so glad he's... Yeah, there's more to read about him.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, that Underwater New York excerpt has been revised, and...
I figured.
And the character has been turned into Torelli Lombardi.
Now, part three, and you've already said this, so it's not a spoiler. Bella runs this truck stop diner cafe in New Jersey. But she also turns tricks upstairs, even at that age, when she's in her 40s or 50s, specializing in initiating young men in the art of sex.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said that Bella, but also your great aunt Emily, was arrested for statutory rape and prostitution.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to leave this for part three, but did Emily beat the charges?
She did.
You're kind of... rooting for her.
She did beat the charges. Yeah, so book two, hopefully, that materializes. That will be Prospect Park, Brooklyn, World War II. That's a bunch of new characters. Some characters carry over from book one. And then book three will take place in the 1950s in this truck stop cafe that was run by my great aunt off of... Route 17 in East Rutherford, New Jersey. There was a room above the diner, the truck stop diner, in which my great aunt turned tricks and initiated high school boys. And she was brought up on charges of statutory rape and prostitution. Yeah.
Now, that must have come from other members of your family and not directly from Emily herself.
Or... Absolutely. Yeah. No, she didn't know I knew any of that. Yeah.
What an amazing life.
Life she had. What a character she was. And I hope I can do her spirit justice.
Oh, my, you do.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Well, there's two more things I wanted to mention, more of a mention than a question, David. And there's an audiobook I saw available now from Tantor Media, who does a great job. I'm surprised that you didn't do the narration, given your acting background, of course, your familiarity with the material.
Yeah. Well, you know, audiobooks, they generally don't like to have the author do it. I don't know what the logic is behind that.
Unless it's Garrison Keillor.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Earl Hamner or something. But I went along with that because I like to hear other people's interpretation of the work. I find that fascinating.
I listen to clips. She does the character voices and it's really well done.
Yeah, she does an excellent job. I love to hear other people interpret the work, and also the idea of recording 11.5 hours of the book. I didn't know that I was up to it, frankly, but it would have been fun, I think. It's funny. I was back in New Jersey on the book tour that I just did. I read at a bookstore in Provincetown. I did some readings in New York City and New Jersey and then San Francisco before coming back to Portland. And I stopped at my relatives in Clifton, New Jersey, my mother's sister, my Aunt Joan, and my cousins were all there. So there was about 16, 17 of us. And they had a feast. It was... 5 pizzas and a huge antipasti platter and a thing of mussels and marinara sauce and shrimp over ice. And it was unbelievable. Donuts and cannoli and pastries just rolled the carpet out. Everybody talking over each other. And my husband, Brian, said when we left, he goes, well, I see where you get it from, you know, and I see where that book came from. But at one point I was sitting across from my cousin Denise's daughter, who's 28 years old, Carly. And I was watching her talk, and I turned to Brian, I turned to my husband, and I said, she's a lot like Bella. And Brian said, oh, yeah. And she caught my eye, and I said, you're like Bella. And she smiled, and I said, you want to read some of the book? And so she said, yes. And we got up, and we did an impromptu reading. She said, give me 5 minutes to prepare. Uh-huh. She took the book. I showed her the Jewish cigar chapter. She sat in a corner for 5 minutes. She read through it. She got up, and then I did the narration. She did all of Bella's dialogue, and it was hilarious. And
well,
she
you
was
record
brilliant.
That. Did anybody have a recorder?
I do.
Your phone?
Oh, okay. I do, and I can't stop watching it. It's hilarious. But just this concept of watching it take on a life of its own, watching other people bring it to life is kind of thrilling. I got to experience a bit of that with the movie, with the screenplay, and it's just fun to me.
So one more thing, and it concerns food. And we talked about when you first came to Portland from Hollywood, and not only did you join writing groups like Dangerous Writers and then the Henry Group, but you also waited tables at a local institution, Mother's Bistro, in downtown Portland, and you're still friends with the owner and head chef Lisa Schroeder, who was there at your Powell's reading, and Lisa declared June Bella Month.
Yeah.
At Mother's, featuring a few dishes from the book, including Belladonna Marie Donata's magic meatballs and tomato gravy, her chicken parmesan, her famous tiramisu. So I just want to let listeners know there's still a few days in the month left to take advantage of that menu. But what an honor and a tribute to you and Bella.
Yeah, that was really spectacular and special. Lisa features a Mother of the Month every month at her restaurant, and she offered to feature Bella. I really loved working at Mother's when I first hit Portland, and she opened her arms to me, and she's a great support to the LGBTQ community, to artists of all stripes, and she's a passionate, passionate woman about food in particular. So we connected on that level. Yeah, that was a real, real nice surprise.
Well, David, thanks so much for joining us here today and in at the KBOO studios. So it's great to do this face-to-face. I wonder if you could leave us with a few words from the Queen of Steeplechase Park. And these are words that end every recipe in the book, but I think it describes not just the recipes, but the reading experience itself.
Absolutely. So at the end of each recipe in the Queen of Steeplechase Park, we have these words. Buon appetito. Mangiare bene, stare bene, delizioso.
Grazie.
Prego.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, David Ciminello, author of the new novel, The Queen of Steeplechase Park, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. David will be part of Insight Queer Writers Read at Literary Arts in Portland on Wednesday, July 17th. He'll also be in conversation with the wonderful Laura Stanfill at the Willamette Writers Conference on Saturday, August 3rd. And he'll be in conversation with the wonderful Stephen Albright at Annie Bloom's Books in Multnomah Village on Tuesday, August 6th. You can find out more about David, his work, and all his upcoming events online at davidciminello.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, usually from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, July 11th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, alla prossima.